Council are getting ready for the second appearance, second oral argument we have this morning. With our newly configured panel, Chief Frisch joins me and Judge Eade, Judge Sleater, myself, I should say. As Council are aware, we are recording these proceedings, so we do ask that you identify yourself by name and who you represent when you begin your comments. We also ask that you keep an eye on the podium clock as well. And then the podium, as you know, can be adjusted as well for your comfort level. No other recording is allowed absent prior approval. The second matter is file A240531. State of Minnesota is the respondent. Nick Adam Chevalier is appellant. And please correct me if I mispronounced appellant's name. And counsel for appellant, when you're ready.
I think it's Chevalier.
Okay, thank you.
I've said it many times in many different ways. And I probably should have asked him.
On the front panel, there is a button if you need to adjust it.
I think I'll just do that. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. May it please the court, my name is Sean McGuire, and I represent the appellant in this case, Nick Chevalier. The questions here are whether the state can make a defendant register where the registrable offense lacks probable cause, and whether this court should insulate that process from review. Because the state never established probable cause for the kidnapping charge in its amended complaint, Mr. Chevalier should not be required to register, and because the Supreme Court and this court have both repeatedly upheld registration-based basis challenges under every procedural scenario, the challenge here was appropriately brought. With regards to probable cause, that's the first thing I want to talk about here, is the state is, I would say, simultaneously pursuing two theories, one pertaining to a June 17 motorcycle trip and one pertaining to an incident the next day where he stood in the doorway while making some threats. The state has never unambiguously stated which incident formed the basis for their kidnapping charge, a fact which underscores the lack of probable cause for either incident.
Counsel, can you help me understand how the issue of probable cause is properly before us now? I mean, it wasn't raised at the omnibus hearing, and he pled guilty and waived his rights.
Yeah.
So how is it properly before us now?
Well,
it's post-conviction.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's on direct appeal. So we stayed the appeal.
Yes, but probable cause is an omnibus issue.
Typically, yeah. However, this court has expressly stated that these types of challenges are appropriately brought in many different scenarios. For example, well, there's failing to make a challenge at the omnibus stage. Haukos, this court specifically approved that and said that's okay.
Can I ask you about that?
Because yep.
did we really specifically approve not making a probable cause challenge and then arguing it on appeal? Because as I look at Haukos, it doesn't look to me like the state challenged the waiver issue before the district court. The state responded to the probable cause argument that Haukos made at the sentencing hearing. Or I guess after the district court requested additional briefing, the state responded simply by saying it's irrelevant, arguing that the statute required registration in all cases, and stated that there's no way to sidestep it. And so that was before the district court. Then on appeal, the state's argument looks like it was that the sex offender registration statute creates an absolute obligation that a defendant register as a sex offender once a triggering charge is brought, and it asserts that the registration requirement persists regardless of the eventual disposition of the triggering charge, and that the district court lacks authority to relieve defendants. So it doesn't look like it was argued before the district court that it was waived by not filing or asking for a contested omnibus hearing before the district court, and it doesn't look like it was argued to us on appeal. And then the only mention of the waiver issue is in footnote 4, it's not really, there's no holding by this court that you can continue to raise a probable cause issue without having a contested omnibus hearing on probable cause. So I'm wondering how we get around case law that says that, you know, we have to read our opinions. We can't imply holdings from opinions. We have to read them in light of the issues that were presented. And it doesn't look like this was ever argued in Halkos.
I think you have to look at the fact that this court emphasized things like the need for a challenge, some kind of check in the system, and the fact that it's not just Halkos. There's a lot of other cases where people have raised challenges to the basis for registration well past the omnibus stage.
But can you point to any case, any precedential opinion of any Minnesota appellate court where there was no contested omnibus hearing, the state argues that you can't now raise it after the contested omnibus hearing, and that is briefed and argued on appeal, and then an appellate court holds you can raise it on direct appeal regardless of the fact that the issue was forfeited or arguably forfeited by not having a contested omnibus? Is there any precedential case that says that?
No, not expressly like that. I would say the closest is Halkos. There, I can point to factual scenarios where it's...
Would those require us to then infer from the appellate decision that, well, the issue was dealt with on the merits and therefore this must be allowed? Is that the upshot of that argument?
I think that's fair. It's also the language that this court and other courts have used to stress the importance of these challenges. I think that's where I would pivot to and suggest that that is kind of a key fact.
But he's not without an ability to challenge probable cause in post-conviction relief if he does it the right way, right? Like if it's an ineffective assistance claim, that's a procedurally proper mechanism. I think our questions, at least speaking for myself, is the mechanism by which this issue is presented in this appeal proper under our case law?
I believe it is, and I believe it is.
And the best authority for that is what case?
Well, I think Halkos is a major part of it. The state mentions the fact that unlike Halkos, this is a guilty plea case. But State versus Berry, Supreme Court from 2021, was a guilty plea case where it was where the defendant challenged registration after the fact, after the plea. Ultimately,
was there a contested omnibus hearing in Berry?
I don't recall. I don't recall if that was specifically contested omnibus argument. I can look. I probably have it, but I don't. I think it was presented to the district court. The question of registration was raised before the district court. This particular case, we actually, I believe we could have just handled it with a direct appeal. We actually stayed the appeal and filed the post-conviction petition. We allowed the state, therefore, could have and didn't. I mean, they didn't. Halkos and Siegel, I think, is the unpublished case from either this year or last year, where emphasizes that these decisions should be reviewed on the face of the complaint, the four corners of the complaint. So the state had an opportunity when it filed its amended complaint to put facts in the complaint to support probable cause. It didn't do that.
Counsel, am I correct? In State versus Lopez, the Supreme Court did do an analysis of probable cause as to one of the brothers, despite the fact there had been a contested omnibus hearing in that case, and the district court had found probable cause for the kidnapping. And by the time it got to the Supreme Court, that it had been, the court did its own analysis of that offense, even though it had been dismissed?
That's correct, yeah.
So what do you make of that in relation to the discussion we're having about Halkos? Because Berry, there was no probable cause analysis, if I recall, by the Supreme Court, so it was just the time, place, and the other factor for requirement for registration.
That's correct.
So how Is that what you're pointing us to, together with Halkos, that for purposes of registration somehow that probable cause is not waived or cannot be waived?
Well, I think for purposes of assessing whether or not a person has to register, I think looking at probable cause for a dismissed charge, for example, I think there has to be a vehicle to review that. And if you don't have a vehicle to review that, what you're essentially going to have, what we have in this case, is the state, as they said, trying to put registration into a plea agreement, therefore, and then say after the fact, well, you pleaded guilty, now it's not reviewable because it's been waived. I think that is highly problematic for a lot of reasons, but mostly because under the state's theory, that would remove this process from review and as a practical matter would do exactly what this court talked about not doing in Halkos, which is to vest prosecutors with unchecked authority to make people register.
Can I jump you back to your original argument on the merits of the probable cause issue? Because I think what you started with was the state never made clear whether it was lying on the June 17th facts or the June 18th facts. Mm-hmm. And you've also argued that, when probable cause is reviewed, it's on the four corners of the complaint. And the amended complaint, both counts, the stalking count and the kidnapping count, list the offense date of on or about June 18th, and then the facts section details the June 18th incident. And we could separately, if you wanted to get into the actual preventing of the victim from leaving the room, you could. But my question is, isn't that enough of, if we're supposed to review this on the four corners of the complaint, and the court's supposed to look at the four corners of the complaint, why isn't the fact that the charge lists the June 18th date and the facts list what happened on June 18th is including that incident where he's standing at the door of the bedroom, why isn't that sufficient notice of what the basis for the kidnapping charge was?
I do think it's sufficient notice. It's just unclear. And it's unclear because when they amended the complaint, the only added facts was this motorcycle trip. And the stalking charge, I believe, if I remember rightly, also lists, I think you said this as well, the same offense date, but it also included other incidents for the stalking charge.
Couldn't that have just been because the predicate for the stalking included what happened on June 18th?
It absolutely could be. And my position is the June 18th threat is absolutely not sufficient to establish probable cause.
You mean the June 17th?
Either one, but I'll start with June 18th since that's where went, and I think that is the fairest reading of looking at the data when you look at the date of offense.
The threat for probable cause for the kidnapping, but I thought the bigger issue for purposes of the kidnapping was, what happened when he's standing at the door.
I'll address that. Because the June 18th incident, the basic facts are that Mr. Schroviller came to the victim's apartment. He assaulted her. She ran and hid under the blanket. He grabbed a curling iron and threatened to burn her with it while standing in the doorway. And the state is saying he was standing in the doorway, preventing her from leaving. Now, it's a little unclear from the complaint whether he was taking active measures to prevent her from leaving or if he was just preventing her from leaving by standing in the doorway. Either way, it doesn't really matter because the Supreme Court addressed, a far more egregious instance of something like this in State versus Smith, where the victim had somebody actively blocking the doorway while the victim was being murdered, and the key fact.
Before you go further, though, you're focusing on the threat as though the incident ended there, because the way it's alleged in the complaint in the probable cause section is that after he's standing in the doorway. Allegedly, according to the complaint, he chokes her until she passes out, and then she wakes up and hears the motorcycle start up and leaves, right? So, did the state need to rely on the threat as the basis for the felony for the kidnapping, or could the state also rely on the assault and or the strangulation there?
I think the state could rely on any of it, honestly, but it still doesn't pass the test. And the reason is because it's incidental, right? It's happening simultaneously. In Smith, they talk about what it means to be not incidental to the arrest. And the confinement has to be a separate act, not concurrent with the offense. There have to be additional purposeful steps beyond the offense to confine.
Counsel, what do you make of the distinction, though, of Smith and I believe Welch and this case, where it's just a matter of, if we get to that point, determining probable cause under the Florence standard based on the face of the complaint versus there you had a trial with facts and then there's a review of this issue of incidental?
I think courts have been pretty clear that when you make a probable cause challenge, you don't get to look at what happened at the trial. You go back in time to the time of the complaint and look at the face of the complaint, and it's as simple as that.
Is that right? If there's a conviction at trial, I think I thought the rule is that because it's basically a sufficiency challenge at that point, so there really isn't a real probable cause issue if there's a conviction after trial.
Of the registrable offense, a conviction of the registrable offense?
I see.
Yeah. That's fine, but the cases have arisen in situations where the registrable offense was acquitted or dismissed and somebody was convicted of a different offense and then has gone back and said, hey, look at this information that happened in the trial. That means that there wasn't probable cause, and the courts have been pretty unanimous in saying, no, you actually have to just look at the four corners of the complaint. I see my time is up. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, counsel. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Travis Smith. I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. Appellant sought post-conviction relief, claiming that the requirement that he register as a predatory offender is unlawful because the kidnapping charge which triggered that requirement was not supported by probable cause. The district court denied appellant's petition, finding that appellant had repeatedly waived opportunities to raise his probable cause challenge, that the complaint provided a sufficient basis to support the kidnapping charge, and then the kidnapping and stalking charges arose out of the same circumstances. This court should affirm the district court for three reasons. First, since the predatory offender registration is not an aspect of appellant's sentence, post-conviction relief is not available to challenge that requirement.
What about Judge Frisch's question? If this had been raised as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in the post-conviction context, as to the failure to make or to request a contested omnibus hearing and challenge it, why wouldn't that be, I mean, assuming we agree with the premise of your argument, why wouldn't that get around the reading that you have of the rule and allow for this to be raised in the post-conviction context?
I think that might be a closer question. I still think it suffers from the same fundamental problem that the attempt to challenge the registration requirement in post-conviction relief does, and that's the plain language of the post-conviction relief statute.
But didn't Barry consider it on direct appeal? And we know here was a direct appeal which was stayed, and we know that any claim brought at post-conviction petition is that which can be brought on a direct appeal. Wouldn't that make it a little bit closer to seem like it's a proper way to bring the issue?
Thank you for that question, Judge Sleater. That anticipated where I was going. The thing with Barry is that the defendant there did raise a challenge in the district court to the registration requirements. Specifically, at the time of his plea hearing, he asked the district court to determine whether the offense that triggered registration arose out of the same set of circumstances as the offense for which he was pleading guilty and convicted.
But couldn't the court just, to get to your main point, it's ancillary, and just there said, no, we're not going to, even if you raised it, it wouldn't matter because it's ancillary to the sentence. That's kind of your main point, and just ended at that point. But instead, they went through the analysis, and that seems like pretty convincing to us, to me, I should say at least, that it's an available tool to raise the issue.
Well, the Barry court certainly could have done that, but I don't know that when anyone, particularly the state, asked the the court to do that or argued that there were it was improperly raised. So the question, but I'm arguing that this is improperly raised here. The other thing that makes this different from Berry is, again, the fact that Berry objected in the district court preserves his objection in some way, shape, or form, ostensibly, if this is something that's subject to review. And therefore, you don't have the plain error issues. Essentially, appellants trying to use post-conviction relief, as I see it, as an end run around the plain error doctrine, because he did not object to the registration requirement in the district court here, sought direct appeal without ever having raised the issue first, then sought a stay to pursue post-conviction relief. Of course, there are two problems.
So your position is that this should be more properly reviewed for plain error rather than just a straight forfeiture under Rule 10?
No, I think we have to answer the forfeiture question before we get to plain error. I think that to a certain extent, there's a strategic advantage to trying to raise this as if you can raise it for the first time on appeal. And I see the post-conviction, because there's a certain circularity to appellant's logic here. The argument is he can raise this in post-conviction relief because he can raise it on direct appeal. In saying he can raise it on direct appeal, he's relying on cases like Haukos and Berry, where the defendant already raised the issue and preserved the objection in the district court in some way, shape, or fashion. Now, I've pushed the waiver envelope back further and say, if you want to raise a probable cause challenge, the rules require you to raise that probable cause challenge at the omnibus. And there's a specific reason for that. It's efficiency, right? And it's also the fact that it affords the parties, both the state and the defendant, the opportunity to present evidence to assist the court in making the probable cause determination.
What do we make then on that issue? Now looking at both the Lopez decision and Haukos, Lopez, there was, at least for one of the brothers, as I recall, in the consolidated case, had been a probable cause hearing, and the court found probable cause, and yet the Supreme Court analyzed whether there was sufficient probable cause for purposes of registration. And then you get to Haukos, and as we were discussing earlier, the issue apparently wasn't raised of a waiver, and yet our court did. When you look at the syllabus points, pretty clear, it triggers only if there's probable cause, and our court then looked whether there was sufficient probable cause on the face of the complaint and found that there was. And there again, those two together seem to suggest, or at least imply, if not explicitly, that there's a distinction of probable cause for purposes of registration versus pretrial probable cause and the Rule 10 waiver.
Well, I think, first of all, I would point out what Judge Ede has brought up a couple of times. Patterns of holding don't create precedent, words do. So that's important. There is no binding precedent that says you can revive a waived probable cause challenge in post-conviction relief or on direct appeal for the first time. That's where we're at here. None of these other cases address that circumstance. I would point out that in Lopez, yes, there was a probable cause challenge at an omnibus hearing. The district court found probable cause for the kidnapping charge. On appeal, the Supreme Court reviewed that decision based on the district court's record. And it applied the two-part standard for reviewing probable cause. It deferred to the district court's findings of fact regarding probable cause for the charge, and then reviewed the question of the legal application of the standard of probable cause to those facts de novo. Here, essentially, the defendant's seeking to deprive the state of the opportunity to present its evidence to support a finding of probable cause and have credibility, to the extent that you can have credibility determinations, but present its evidence and have a finder of fact make those findings at an omnibus hearing and try and essentially play a game of gotcha. I'll agree to plead guilty to a charge and dismiss the kidnapping charge, acknowledge that I'm required to register as a result of this plea, and then later when I'm unhappy, I want to deprive the state of its opportunity to marshal its full case to establish probable cause. I'm not saying that a defendant should never be able to challenge probable cause for an offense that triggers a registration mechanism. I'm simply saying the rules provide that opportunity. It's called an omnibus hearing.
I mean, this dovetails into my question, which is, there's an additional layer of waiver here, and that is he waived his rights and pled guilty after the district court expressly indicated that there would be a registration, or the state, one or the other, indicated there would be a registration requirement. What is the significance of the waiver of rights and the guilty plea to the ability of the defendant to challenge, or the appellant to challenge this issue in the manner it has challenged now?
I think it's very significant because a guilty plea waives all non-jurisdictional defects with the proceedings. Probable cause is a non-jurisdictional defect, and so one of the specific things that happens in a plea colloquy, right, is the waiver of a right to a pretrial hearing at which you can contest probable cause for the charges against you.
Does this mean that the real way that the appellant has to challenge this particular issue is a motion to withdraw the plea as unintelligent or manifest injustice? Is that what should have happened here?
I think that might be more appropriate. A defendant might have some difficulties because of the collateral consequence doctrine and whether that renders a plea unintelligent or involuntary.
I mean, the issue that your esteemed colleague has raised is that if we don't do it this way, we have no other mechanism. And so I'm trying to get at what are the other mechanisms to get at the same finish line that he's seeking to get to. Is it a motion to withdraw a plea? Is it an ineffective assistance claim on post-conviction relief? What does that look like? And are those more appropriate than the way that we're here today?
I certainly think they're more appropriate. And even trying to straightforwardly argue on appeal that this was, I mean, essentially it's plain error to require him to register, acknowledging the fact that he didn't preserve his objection to the registration requirement and embracing plain error. But he's never done that.
What about the fact that he didn't plead guilty to kidnapping, right? So the waiver of rights related to the plea to stalking.
The waiver of rights relates to all of the pleas in the charge. If you look at Rule 15, you're acknowledging what the charges are against you, that you have all of these rights related to the charges, and that as a result of a plea agreement, you're waiving those rights and pleading guilty to a particular charge.
Was that the exact colloquy in this case?
It wasn't the exact colloquy in this case, but the colloquy did specifically include an acknowledgement that he could have a pretrial hearing and that he wasn't having that.
I guess that would go to Chief Judge Frisch's question as to whether a better vehicle would be plea withdrawal or...
I think it certainly would be a better vehicle, a more appropriate fit, and then we could have the straightforward conversations about collateral consequences, whether this is the kind of collateral consequence that would allow a plea withdrawal, like a Padilla sort of issue, and whether it should be an exception to that rule. But we're not here having those conversations because this isn't a plea withdrawal case, because the defendant wants to retain the benefit of his bargain.
I want to take you back to your plain error comments, because you made that earlier in your argument. You just said it again recently. I didn't see you advancing that standard in your briefs or in your brief. And so I'm wondering, setting aside the post-conviction issue, if this just went up on direct appeal and there was no contested omnibus hearing, there's a waiver of rights at the plea, then would we first determine that there's a forfeiture and then apply the plain error standard, or do we stop after the forfeiture? Is this different from other plain error cases?
I think if the appellant sought to avail himself of the plain error doctrine, it's not my obligation to show that it wasn't plain error in the first instance. I think if the appellant straightforwardly acknowledged I didn't raise this below, by doing so I've waived that issue and it should be reviewed for plain error, and here's why I prevail on plain error. That's the order it goes. You have to determine the waiver. If the waiver is conceded, then you can proceed directly to plain error. But if there's a contest about whether there's been waiver, then certainly you would address the waiver forfeiture error issue. If you determine that it's been forfeited, you would then consider plain error if the party who's seeking the benefit of the plain error doctrine invokes it. I want to correct a claim in the reply brief that I didn't raise this waiver issue in the post-conviction court. My memorandum in opposition to the petition at pages 7 to 9 Doc ID number, I think 137, clearly argues the same argument that's in my brief to this court about post-conviction relief not being the appropriate vehicle. And I clearly have consistently made the waiver argument by not raising it. Appellants never argued that it was plain error to require him to register in response to my arguments that he waived this issue by failing to raise it at the omnibus hearing. So plain error is not something that's available for the appellant at this point in time, unless this court's inclined to order supplemental briefing on that issue.
Counsel, getting back to your earlier comment, when I asked about whether it was direct appeal in Berry or there had been a probable cause finding in Lopez, and then, of course, in Halco's thing, the judge brought up the issue before sentencing, and you suggested, well, in those ways it's preserved. Is that your point in that regard, that if it's somewhere along the line up until or maybe, well, before a direct appeal is taken, it's raised before the district court, it could even be like in Halco's, right before sentencing, maybe right after sentencing when the judge imposes registration, I object to registration. Is that how, is that what you're indicating would be at least a minimum process a defendant would have to do to preserve the issue on direct appeal?
Yeah, I think that is at the farthest reaches you can go. My primary argument is that if you want to challenge probable cause for a charge for whatever purpose, you need to make that challenge at the omnibus hearing as the rules require. And the rules explicitly say that failure to raise these issues at omnibus constitutes a waiver. This court and the Supreme Court have consistently applied that rule.
Can I just follow up on that, because it seems like it would almost need to be an educational and a paradigm change, because, as you know, as a practical matter, the attorneys and judge often are confused with offenses and whether registerable and all those sort of things, and then we kind of work it out during a PSI and it happens at the end. But is your suggestion and maybe advice, in this case to defense counsel, that as a regular matter, even if the kidnapping offense largely might have been an offense you're already pre-negotiating to get rid of, we're just really more concerned about this, it should be raised, and it should be raised before the Rule 10 in all cases where there's a registrable offense.
And certainly, and I think the state can waive those procedural defects in negotiating a plea agreement, and there are creative ways for prosecutors and defense attorneys to reach plea agreements that address and even eliminate registration requirements that arise as a result of charges that are being dismissed. As a trial prosecutor, I've certainly done it. We have mechanisms. If that's something that is really an issue to a defendant, there's a time and a place to address that, and that's in the district court at the very least before direct appeal is taken. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to get right to a question that Judge Ead brought up here, which just basically has to do with, well, okay, so this waiver question, and I think the important thing, I disagree that you waive everything when you plead guilty. I'll start with that premise. You waive challenges to the conviction. You don't waive challenges to your sentence. You don't waive challenges to the plea itself. These are things that
Do you waive omnibus issues?
What's that?
Do you waive omnibus issues?
I think for the thing that you're pleading guilty to, this is a separate animal. This creature here is kind of a weird thing, because we're not really talking about the conviction. We're talking about something. This isn't about the offense. This is about something that was dismissed. And so it does kind of exist in a black hole.
But let's assume that Mr. Smith is right and this followed Rule 15 and there was a waiver that encompassed the dismissed charge at the time. I was trying to pull up the transcript, but I was having some trouble with my computer. Let's just assume that's the case. And so that's a little different than not asking for a contested omnibus hearing. That's an affirmative waiver of pretrial issues, to the Chief's point. What's your authority that you could then, after that, preserve at the sentencing hearing or in a later post-conviction proceeding, resurrect that claim if there's been an affirmative? Because we're no longer talking about a forfeiture by not asking for a contested omnibus hearing. Now we're talking about an affirmative waiver.
I, I think you have to step back a little bit and look at how the statute is structured, because it's not about, as I was saying before, it's not really about the conviction. It creates an obligation. The registration statute creates an obligation that is divorced from a finding of guilt. And as a result, there's no state interest in making people register whose charge that for a registrable offense is not supported by probable cause.
But if the thrust of your argument is that there's no probable cause and there's an affirmative waiver before the district court of probable cause issues at the time of the guilty plea, then how can we consider that now?
I mean, I think you can consider it because the importance of the issue, because this is registration goes oftentimes it goes much longer than whatever sentence is going to be handed out. Ultimately, it's kind of a public policy question, I think, or a public safety question, which is, should this person have to register? And to tie it to a moment in time when information might not be complete at the omnibus stage, I think, first of all, courts have not done that. There hasn't been a court that has said this has been waived. So I think...
But what do you make of the point that Mr. Smith makes, that distinguishing the, you know, why did Berry consider it despite a plea of guilty, but it had been raised below, and it had been raised in some form apparently in Lopez, and we know it did in Halkos right before sentencing. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, the state had one other thing I thought was interesting, which was that there's some strategic advantage. Halkos kind of makes clear that actually the advantage, like they're limited, the challenge is limited, because you can't put anything else in the record. It just has to depend on the four corners of the complaint. Siegel does the same thing and elaborates. That's an unpublished case, but it elaborates a little further on that fact. And so I think ultimately, as I see it, you know, this idea that the defendant is going to have some advantage by you know, I guess, what, keeping its powder dry or something and not making the challenge on the front end, I just think is belied by the fact that this court has repeatedly said, you just look at the complaint. The standard is very low. The probable cause standard is very low. Most cases that have said the basis for a registration is invalid have relied on the other part of the test, which is more or less, is it arise out of the same circumstances.
To Mr. Smith's point, I think at a Florence hearing, generally what happens is if there is some deficiency in probable cause, the state has the opportunity to supplement its evidence in order to substantiate the charges.
And one of the things I think is most important to remember here is that we didn't just file the appeal. We stated the appeal, filed the post-conviction, gave the state an opportunity to. They could have replied by attaching police reports and witness statements and other things that they would want.
Which is not their burden.
I'm just saying, if we're trying to pretend that I've somehow avoided the Florence hearing, that they had every opportunity. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today, as well as your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement and issue a ruling within 90 days. You each have a good day.